In Connecticut, the Supreme Court ruled this month that the company that made the AR-15-style Bushmaster, used by Adam Lanza in 2012 to massacre children and teachers at Sandy Hook Elementary School, could be sued. It's a case brought by Sandy Hook victims' families who cited the marketing of the firearm and is a challenge to the immunity Congress gave gun manufacturers from litigation. This legal decision is now closely watched and will have ramifications no matter the verdict. We asked John Culhane to join us. He's a professor of law, co-director of the Family Health Law and Policy Institute at Widener University, Delaware Law School. He's also a contributing writer to Politico, which is where we saw his article about this Connecticut Supreme Court ruling. And John Culhane, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks.
And to let me just add a couple of things. The very sad and tragic news that yesterday, Jeremy Richmond, the father of one of those children murdered at Sandy Hook, died yesterday, apparently of a suicide. We also have news today that officially the federal government has banned bump stocks going into effect today. And this is, of course, after the mass shooting on October 2017 in Las Vegas. 58 people were killed. So we've got these, on one hand, this tragedy. On the other hand, it looks like at least some movement to ban some of these more dangerous weapons.
Some movement. I have to say it's not much. And when you compare what's happened here with what's happened in New Zealand, the contrast is pretty striking. One of the things that strikes me about the suicide, and of course there were two suicides in Parkland within the last 10 days, yeah, is we think about the victims and the immediate victims, but the kind of the tragedy and the long-term effect on the survivors, can go on for decades and be devastating. And it's not surprising that people are trying to find ways around this statute, which makes bringing a lawsuit, let alone winning one, extremely difficult. So maybe I can talk a little bit about the law and,
sure,
and then sort of talk about the Connecticut court and how they found a way around it, essentially.
Yeah, let's break it down. Because
yeah,
this is a little complicated.
It is.
And we should say, and I mentioned this in my introduction, is that there is a kind of immunity that Congress gave to gun manufacturers from litigation.
There is. So in 2005, Congress passes something called the Protection of Legal Commerce in Arms Act. And what that does is make it extremely difficult to sue gun sellers, manufacturers, you know, distributors and retailers in connection with the sale and eventual, you know, harm caused by guns. And the reason this was passed, in addition to the power of the NRA, obviously, is that there were some lawsuits brought by cities claiming that these guns saturating the market were a public nuisance.
Chicago being one,
Newark, I think Gary, Indiana. There were several of these, and some courts were dismissing them, but some of them were starting to make it to the appellate level. And the concern was that the gun sellers don't have the same kind of deep pockets, for example, as tobacco, and there was concern that they could be bankrupted by these lawsuits. So for that reason, Congress passes this law, which essentially says that with certain very narrow exceptions, you can't sue a gun seller if the gun operates as it's supposed to operate, essentially. So what that means is you can't get at the manufacturer of the gun, even if the gun is extremely lethal, for example. And you think, well, of course a gun is lethal, but there are degrees. So
sure,
a revolver is quite different from an AR-15, right? So there are two exceptions to this, though, and this is what brings in what the Connecticut Supreme Court did. So the first exception – well, actually, there are several exceptions, but two that potentially applied. One is the idea of negligent entrustment, and the second is the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act.
So negligent
entrustment. So let me talk about that. So negligent entrustment is, yeah, I'll give you sort of the Reader's Digest.
The 30-second version.
Is essentially you sold a gun to a person who shouldn't have had one, sort of like flipping your car keys to someone who's drunk. There are certain situations where a person should not have a dangerous instrument. And negligent entrustment claims are sort of bracketed and survive. The problem is they're trying to apply it here to the entire civilian population, saying what you negligently entrusted was this military-grade weapon that really should be for law enforcement and the military. And so it's a general negligent entrustment to the entire civilian population. And both the trial court and the Connecticut Supreme Court were not buying that. They said this is a radical extension of common law. The idea of negligent entrustment, it's the person directly injured. So that didn't work. The second argument, though, is more powerful, as it turns out. So like most states, Connecticut has an unfair trade practices law. And essentially it says, among other things, that anyone who's injured in any way, it can be financially, but as the court interpreted, it could be physical injury or death, by an unfair or a deceptive trade practice, can sue the person who engaged in the practice. And the argument here is a marketing argument, that they marketed this gun particularly for people like Adam Lanza, who was the shooter in Sandy Hook, basically sort of appealing to his militaristic
fantasy life.
Exactly.
Well, let me pick up on a couple of things. So what the Supreme Court then in Connecticut ruled said, they were looking at how this gun was being marketed to people.
That's right.
And that they were – that they – that I guess the people who want to – who are suing these gun manufacturers can use that argument in court.
That's right, although the court did say it was going to be difficult. So the first piece of the argument is, first of all, whether this law even applies. And they said that it did, because if the court said – imagine a case where it was very clear that they were marketing this specifically as a weapon of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. The court said those aren't these facts, but we can't imagine that Congress intended to exclude cases of outrageous marketing, essentially, if I can paraphrase. So the first piece of it is, did that marketing actually affect Adam Lanza in the way where he chose among different weapons, he picked the most lethal and the most militaristic? And then the second difficulty is, and did that increase the number of victims, and how would you prove that? So all the court is deciding now is that he has stated a claim. The case should go back to the trial court to make a decision about whether the facts can establish the theory that he's suing under.
Well, and I mean, here's some obvious arguments against that, which is that there are plenty of people that have this weapon and have never killed anybody with that weapon or massacred a classroom of children, for instance.
Right. But that's really not much of an argument legally, because there are lots of things. There are plenty of people who, drive negligently but don't happen to get into an accident. So we sort of look at the actual consequences, right, and say, was this an increased risk? And if there's an increased risk that can be traced to the marketing, the fact that there are other people who didn't take the same action really shouldn't be an impediment.
And the marketing, I've seen some of this marketing, and it does sell this military style weapon as it has all the sort of markings of what it would be to be in the military.
Yeah, so they promoted this as the uncompromising choice when you demand a rifle as mission adaptable as you are. They talk about soldiers moving on patrol through jungles. And this is probably the most outrageous. Forces of opposition bow down. You are single-handedly outnumbered. And I think that in particular really caught the court's attention.
Well, and it does play into the fantasy. You mentioned the word fantasy. A fantasy life of, it looks like, Adam Lanza.
That's right. So we have to be really careful about making an equation between people that are mentally disturbed, of course, and violence. But in this particular case, here was a person who had this fantasy life, and apparently the weapons had been purchased by his mother, but she had quite an arsenal. And the idea is that he chose – there were swords in there and there were pistols, but he chose this weapon. And the argument is that he did that because of the marketing, because he knew it would be more lethal, and because it sort of spoke to these fantasies that he had about, being in the military and taking down enemies.
Is the court saying deal with how this weapon is promoted, or are they saying this is a weapon that is a military weapon and should not be in civilian hands?
No, the second argument is kind of foreclosed by the statute. So what they really are saying is this is really about the marketing, and really what Congress intended to do was kind of rule out claims based on the lethality of the weapon itself. But the unfair trade practices really goes to, sort of think of any fraudulent marketing. And that's how the court looked at this case. It might as well be, you know, selling a car that's a lemon, for example, or saying it had features that it didn't have. This is just a more extreme example. And before this case and before the passage of the congressional statute, there had been some claims about negligent marketing, which were, you know, that a manufacturer saturated the market and didn't really keep track of where the guns were going. And those were not really getting any traction, but there was some concern that they would. The argument is that this is much worse. This is not just failing to keep tabs on where your guns are going. This is actively sending them out with a message that makes it likelier that they'll be used illegally, not for self-defense, not for hunting, not for legal purposes for which guns should be sold.
We're almost having a break here. I mean, clearly these guns have been used in these mass shootings because of their lethality. But if you look at most murders or most crimes committed with guns, they're not these weapons.
That's right. So it depends on whether we look at mass shootings or whether we look at kind of the, you know, horrible background of shootings that go on every day. If you look at mass shootings, they do tend to be the weapon of choice, particularly in these cases where you've got 40, 50 people, massacred. So, you're not going to solve all of those problems with this lawsuit. All you're getting at is a very small piece. And as maybe I can talk about after the break, the litigation, though, could have kind of a secondary effect, which is in part what the manufacturers fear and also in part drove the federal statute's enactment.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's John Culhane. He's a professor of law, co-director of the Family Health Law and Policy Institute. That's at Widener University Delaware Law School. He's a regular contributor to Politico, and we saw that he wrote an article recently looking at a decision by the Connecticut Supreme Court that seemed to open the doors to suing gun manufacturers for how they are promoting some of their guns. And some of their more lethal guns, I should say. Do you think gun manufacturers should be sued? Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with law professor John Culhane about whether gun manufacturers should be held accountable for things like mass shootings. And it looks like a Connecticut Supreme Court ruling has opened the door to those kinds of lawsuits. And we would love to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. From your perspective, though, John, are you looking to use, would you like this lawsuit to essentially prohibit the sale of these, you know, AR-15 style weapons, guns?
Well, there's two questions there. One is what I would like to see, and my own preference would be for legislation that would ban weapons like this. I don't think that this lawsuit, even if it's fully successful, can achieve that result. It would more be to stop the marketing practices. And so it might be that without those marketing practices, you can't sell as many of those guns. So it could have that effect. But again, this is pretty specific. And I think one reason the case will likely survive appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. It could happen if the court decides to take cert on it, which is a sort of a maybe. It could survive because they are not trying to drive the guns from the market, but just to stop unscrupulous marketing practices. And the idea that the state doesn't have the ability to do that, as the Connecticut Supreme Court said, this is kind of the only recourse when these outrageous marketing practices are taking place. And if this were any other industry, we wouldn't have a question about whether this created a private right of action. So it's not really a tort claim, because it's based in this state statute, even though the effect could be similar compensation to what you would get in the tort claim.
I'm thinking about, you know, other ways that, for instance, cars are sold. So if using this as an example, would the advertising for, let's say, a fancy car be, you can drive 250 miles an hour.
Exactly.
And you don't have to stop at red lights. And you can, I mean, that the laws essentially don't apply to you.
Well, you know those things that say, this is a professional driver,
yes,
do not attempt.
Right? Yes.
So if you take those out and then make it more outrageous, either visually, I was thinking about this example, you showed somebody driving a sedan 200 miles an hour and you said, you know, get the rush or something like that. You don't have to say much. A lot of it, a lot of the way we communicate is through these, you know, images and these visuals. And, you know, I think for a state to be powerless to stop something like this, or some entity, whether it's a federal or state level, to be powerless to stop that, which would strike us as nuts. Mm. So I think all the court is saying is if, in fact, these marketing practices are established, and if much more difficult, they can establish, the plaintiffs can establish that it made a difference in this case. Because Adam Lanz is dead, it's hard to know exactly what was going on there.
Right.
But presumably, we can then have some kind of recourse for these plaintiffs.
I wonder, too, whether there are lessons from how the government eventually dealt with tobacco companies or cigarette makers, sellers.
The lesson there is really about litigation and the course of litigation. And one of the things I mentioned on the Politico article is that once these lawsuits are allowed to go forward, what you get is the unearthing of documents, of internal correspondence, assuming it's not protected by some privilege, which right. It turns out a lot of the documents are not protected, that show, in the case of tobacco, for example, that's how we learned that the industry executives knew that nicotine was addictive. We didn't. I mean, we thought we knew that, but here we had them talking. But they knew that. Exactly. Here we had them talking about it. So similarly here, there's this possibility that I think advocates of gun control are hoping for, that even if this doesn't result in the repeal of the law, it could result sort of collaterally in the imposition of new restrictions. And for example, in the case of tobacco, in the wake of these documents coming out, we had the master settlement agreement where the states got, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars to use. There are some questions about how
for
they're using
it. And
yeah,
like that.
They're not always using it that way, or not even a high percentage of it. But that was the idea, and it did do some good, which is ban certain kinds of marketing. If you'll remember, marketing to kids, certain restrictions on billboards. So there were, you know, collateral consequences that inure to the public's health.
Let me read a couple of comments here, one on our Facebook page from Joseph, who says, I doubt any lawsuit in any state against a gun manufacturer will be upheld by the Supreme Court. Do you share his view?
Well, if the Supreme Court were to decide the case on the merits with the composition of the current court, I think he's probably correct. I think the kind of prior question is whether the court thinks this is something they want to deal with. So what you – and it's complicated in this case, and I'll try to break it down. So the Connecticut Supreme Court is applying the Connecticut law and saying that one of the exceptions to the federal law, which is if you violate a state statute that applies, you can be held liable. And the state statute here, of course, is the Unfair Trade Practices Law. What the Supreme Court could say is that Congress didn't intend for this exception to be read so broadly. They really meant it to be used in cases where there's specific legislation about guns and not these unfair trade practices laws. Hmm. There's nothing in the statute that – in the federal statute that says that. And in fact, I was looking at the findings, and the findings talk about how they don't want – I'm talking about the findings Congress made before they passed the law. The findings say that Congress did not want to stop the lawful sale and marketing of guns. Well, if this is unlawful marketing, then I think there's an argument that at least the statute is ambiguous enough. And what the Supreme Court could say if it took the case was, you know, since this is taking away a right that would have existed at common law, we should read the exceptions narrowly, so against Congress in the sense that if they want to bar these suits, they should make that very clear.
Right. We are talking more about marketing than we are about guns.
Right. I mean, the guns are sort of the subject of the marketing, and they would be affected, but kind of as a secondary thing.
Let me read a tweet from Jamie, who says, my husband is in law enforcement. We are gun owners who believe in gun control. We also believe gun manufacturers should not be responsible. That would be like making car manufacturers responsible for car accidents. And I raised that earlier, which is that most people, I'm sure our listener here, who have guns are not misusing them or using them for criminal purposes.
Right. And it's a powerful analogy, but I think sometimes people draw the wrong conclusions from it, because we think about things that are deadly. You know, automobiles come right to the fore. So let's compare a couple of cases. In one case, you might have somebody who is, you know, simply out there driving recklessly, or, you know, trying to mow people down, or is reckless because they're drunk or something along those lines. And if the car causes an injury or fatality in that case, unless I knew a lot more, nobody would say that the car manufacturer should be liable for that. It's a different thing, as we've said earlier, if the manufacturer is marketing and selling the gun as – I'm sorry, the car as able to go 250 miles an hour, and they show somebody on a speedway and people sort of take that and run with it. You know, these marketing – we know the reason – firms hire advertising agencies, right, and marketing firms, is that marketing works. We right. know this. And there's a reason why all of this thought and money was spent on the marketing campaign for this particular weapon. So, you know, just like any other consumer product.
Well, and consumer products, broadly speaking, do sell oftentimes, you know, a fantasy of good health, of adventure, yeah. of beauty,
exactly.
of all of that.
Exactly.
So,
I'm still waiting. But yeah, so yeah, right.
But I'm just saying, part of advertising is to promote something.
It's an image, right? You're trying to speak to a lifestyle or an image. And in most cases, that's, you know, benign enough. We could argue about whether it is. But in a case like this, if these allegations really are true, the Connecticut Supreme Court really expressed a certain kind of outrage toward the end of its decision, that if these allegations are true and if this marketing really is as outrageous as suggested, and if it led to the consequences, big right. question to be determined,
right.
then why shouldn't we have accountability in a case like that?
One of the reasons we wanted to do the show is of what New Zealand did in response to the mass shooting at the mosque last week. And I mentioned a couple of things that they have done, including banning assault weapons, but other buybacks and other things as well.
Australia, too, for that matter.
Exactly.
Right? After a 1996 mass shooting, they immediately banned assault weapons, and they had a very successful buyback program. And they've had exactly one mass shooting since then, which happened last year.
America is not New Zealand or Australia, as we know.
This is true.
How do you see – I mean, they don't have a Second Amendment with
right.
all the things that come with it. Do you think that's the difference, or is it more than that?
Well, I think the Second Amendment, the fact that we have a Second Amendment, kind of reflects the view of guns that have been held since the founding. So I don't think you can separate out those right. two. And it really is – we do have a gun culture. For example, in the U.S., for every 100 people, there are 120 guns.
Yeah.
The next closest country, I think, is Yemen, with like a 1-to-1 ratio. And then it drops pretty precipitously. So, you know, Americans like this person who tweeted in love their guns. And there are people who are responsible gun owners. And the way you have to pitch this, if you're going to get any progress, is not about responsible gun ownership, but is about things that really great majorities of Americans agree with, like background checks, which are only held in certain kinds of cases and not at gun shows, not in the secondary market, et cetera, et cetera. That's just an obvious one that has something like 90% support. So I think the trick is to translate that support into something that can break through the, you know, sclerotic Congress when it comes to gun legislation. The only thing we had that was successful, or that was substantial, we can argue about whether it was successful, is the assault weapons ban, but that expired of its own accord and was not renewed.
So, and there were a lot of workarounds.
There were a lot of workarounds, yes.
We should add that the House of Representatives passed the, quote, Bipartisan Background Check Act of 2019. So there is some movement on that front. And again, as of today, a federal ban on bump stocks
yes.
goes into effect. This is a response to the mass shooting October 2017. It was in Las Vegas. A man essentially killed 58 people and wounded many, many more. A bump stock allows a firearm essentially to act like an automatic weapon.
That's right. That's right. And As I understand it, there's already a lawsuit that's being fired up in response to this ban. And the argument is usually around the Second Amendment. And the Supreme Court has been sort of coy up until now about how broad a right the Second Amendment confers. We know from a couple of cases about 20 years ago or so that there is a right to own a gun for self-defense.
That's Scalia, right?
That's right. That's
the
Heller decision. Very good. It's a major decision where the court holds 5-4 that the Washington statute that prohibited people from owning guns for self-defense was unconstitutional. But he said, but there's plenty of room for regulation. And the Supreme Court has really kind of stayed away from guns. And that's one reason I think they might not take this case. Mm-hmm. Justice Thomas, in particular, has called the Second Amendment an orphan and says that we should be taking these cases. If this were abortion or if this were First Amendment issues, we would have taken several cases by now. But I think the court has made a quasi-political decision to kind of let states and to some extent Congress, to the extent it will do anything, sort of take the lead on this.
But I wonder whether there isn't movement or some kind of action more on the state level, thinking of Connecticut. Other states as well, where maybe the federal government isn't doing what people want, but on the state level there is some action.
There's action in both directions, though. So you've got states, sort of the blue states, if I can oversimplify this, which are making it more difficult or supposedly impossible to get these assault weapons. Of course, people can bring them from other states, but it does impose a hurdle. It does impose a difficulty. And then in some of the red states, saying things like, well, you can carry a concealed weapon without a permit is a recent law from one state, which I think maybe Florida, but I could be wrong about that. But so you have movement in both directions. And because the market for guns is, at least to some extent, national, you know, it is one of our, I don't know, hallmarks that we have these, you know, laboratories of federalism where states do different things. But when it comes to something like guns, you kind of need some kind of national response, I think.
Ronnie called into the show and said, I was at a gun show last week and did have to undergo a background check.
Oh, that's great. So that could be pursuant to state law, I would imagine.
We're almost out of time here. You wrote an article a couple of years ago in the New York Times that there should be some kind of a gun tax paid by the manufacturer or the importer.
Yes. So the argument, I co-wrote this with Lucinda Finley, who's a professor at Buffalo, and we made the argument that particularly for these mass shootings, there's no recourse. There's no compensation. Let's face it, you're not going to get compensation from the shooter in the vast majority of cases. Either they're dead or they're penniless or both. And so our argument was that these have real consequences, and a compensation fund like we had for 9/11, like we have for coal miners, like we have for people injured by vaccines that have side effects. To us, this case was much more compelling because there's the public health benefit of vaccines makes compensation really a no-brainer. Here, people on either side can argue about whether guns further or impede public health. But in any case, there should be some kind of way of compensating those people.
Well, we are going to end on that note. John Culhane, thanks for joining us today. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Pleasure to have you back. Professor of Law, co-director of the Family Health Law and Policy Institute. That's at Widener University, Delaware Law School. And again, a contributing writer to Politico. And we will post his article that we saw from Politico on our Facebook page. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. And you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. We always want to hear from you. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen, with help today from Susan Greenbaum. I'm Artie Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.